lying, pretending I knew all about it. And in the car going home, I sat in my corner, biting my thumbnail, seeing the great hall at Manderley thronged with people in fancy dress, the chatter, hum and laughter of the moving crowd, the musicians in the gallery, supper in the drawing-room probably, long buffet tables against the wall, and I could see Maxim standing at the front of the stairs, laughing, shaking hands, turning to someone who stood by his side. Tall and slim with dark hair, said the bishop's wife. Dark hair against a white face. Someone whose quick eyes saw to the comfort of her guests, who gave an order over her shoulder to a servant, someone who was never awkward, never without grace, who, when she danced, left a stab of perfume in the air like a white azalea. "Will you be entertaining much at Manderley, Mrs. de Winter?" I heard the voice again, suggestive, rather inquisitive, in the voice of that woman I had called upon who lived the other side of Kerith. And I saw her eye, too, dubious, considering, taking in my clothes from top to toe, wondering, with that swift downward glance given to all brides, if I was going to have a baby. I did not want to see her again. I did not want to see any of them again. They only came to call at Manderley because they were curious and prying. They liked to criticize my looks, my manners, my figure. They liked to watch how Maxim and I behaved to each other, whether we seemed fond of one another, so that they could go back afterwards and discuss us, saying, "Very different from the old days." They came because they wanted to compare me to Rebecca. I would not return these calls any more, I decided. I should tell Maxim so. I did not mind if they thought me rude and ungracious. It would give them more to criticize, more to discuss. They could say I was ill-bred. "I'm not surprised," they would say. "After all, who was she?" And then a laugh and a shrug of the shoulder. "My dear, don't you know? He picked her up in Monte Carlo or somewhere. She hadn't a penny. She was a companion to some old woman." More laughter, more lifting of the eyebrows. "Nonsense, not really. How extraordinary men are. Maxim, of all people, who was so fastidious. How could he, after Rebecca?" I did not mind. I did not care. They could say what they liked. As the car turned in at the lodge gates, I leant forward in my seat to smile at the woman who lived there. She was bending down, picking flowers in the front garden. She straightened up as she heard the car, but she did not see me smile. I waved, and she stared at me blankly. I don't think she knew who I was. I leant back in my seat again. The car went on down the drive. When we turned at one of the narrow bends, I saw a man walking along the drive a little distance ahead. It was the agent, Frank Crawley. He stopped when he heard the car, and the chauffeur slowed down. Frank Crawley took off his hat and smiled when he saw me in the car. He seemed glad to see me. I smiled back at him. It was nice of him to be glad to see me. I liked Frank Crawley. I did not find him dull or uninteresting as Beatrice had done. Perhaps it was because I was dull myself. We were both dull. We neither of us had a word to say for ourselves. Like to like. I tapped on the glass and told the chauffeur to stop. "I think I'll get out and walk with Mr. Crawley," I said. He opened the door for me. "Been paying calls, Mrs. de Winter?" he said. "Yes, Frank," I said. I called him Frank because Maxim did, but he would always call me Mrs. de Winter. He was that sort of person. Even if we had been thrown on a desert island together and lived there in intimacy for the rest of our lives, I should have been Mrs. de Winter. "I've been calling on the bishop," I said, "and I found the bishop out, but the bishop's lady was at home. She and the bishop are very fond of walking. Sometimes they do 20 miles a day in the Pennines." "I don't know that part of the world," said Frank Crawley. "They say the country round is very fine. An uncle of mine used to live there." It was the sort of remark Frank Crawley always made. Safe, conventional, very correct. "The bishop's wife wants to know when we're going to give a fancy dress ball at Manderley," I said, watching him out of the tail of my eye. "She came to the last one," she said, "and enjoyed it very much. I did not know you have fancy dress dances here, Frank." He hesitated a moment before replying. He looked a little troubled. "Oh, yes," he said after a moment. The Manderley Ball was generally an annual affair. Everyone in the county came, a lot of people from London, too, quite a big show. It must have taken a lot of organisation, I said. Yes, he said. I suppose, I said carelessly, Rebecca did most of it. I looked straight ahead of me along the drive, but I could see his face was turned towards me, as though he wished to read my expression. We all of us worked pretty hard, he said quietly. There was a funny reserve in his manner as he said this, a certain shyness that reminded me of my own. I wondered suddenly if he had been in love with Rebecca. His voice was the sort of voice I should have used in his circumstances had this been so. The idea opened up a new field of possibilities. Frank Crawley being so shy, so dull, he would never have told anyone, least of all Rebecca. "I'm afraid I should not be much use if we have a dance," I said. "I'm no earthly use at organizing anything."
"There would be no need for you to do anything," he said. "You would just be yourself and look decorative."
"That's very polite of you, Frank," I said. "But I'm afraid I should not be able to do that very well either."
"I think you would do it excellently," he said.
Dear Frank Crawley. How tactful he was, and considerate. I almost believed him. But he did not deceive me, really. "Will you ask Maxim about the ball?" I said.
"Why don't you ask him?" he answered.
"No," I said. "No, I don't like to." We were silent then. We went on walking along the drive. Now that I had broken down my reluctance at saying Rebecca's name, first with the bishop's wife and now with Frank Crawley, the urge to continue was strong within me. It gave me a curious satisfaction. It acted upon me like a stimulant. I knew that in a moment or two I should have to say it again. "I was down on one of the beaches the other day," I said, "the one with the breakwater. Jasper was being infuriating. He kept barking at the poor man with the idiot's eyes."
"You must mean Ben," said Frank, his voice quite easy now. "He always potters about on the shore. He's quite a nice fellow. You need never be frightened of him. He would not hurt a fly."
"Oh, I wasn't frightened," I said. I waited a moment, humming a tune to give me confidence. "I'm afraid that cottage place is going to rack and ruin," I said lightly. "I had to go in to find a piece of string or something to tie up Jasper. The china is mouldy and the books are being ruined. Why isn't something done about it? It seems such a pity." I knew he would not answer at once. He bent down to tie up his shoelace. I pretended to examine a leaf on one of the shrubs. "I think if Maxim wanted anything done, he would tell me," he said, still fumbling with his shoe. "Are they all Rebecca's things?" I asked.
"Yes," he said.
I threw the leaf away and picked another, turning it over in my hands. "What did she use the cottage for?" I asked. "It looked quite furnished. I thought from the outside it was just a boathouse."
"It was a boathouse originally," he said. His voice constrained again, difficult, the voice of someone who is uncomfortable about his subject.
Then she converted it like that, had furniture put in and china. I thought it funny the way he called her she. He did not say Rebecca or Mrs. de Winter, as I expected him to do. "Did she use it a great deal?" I asked.
"Yes," he said. "Yes, she did. Moonlight picnics and one thing and another."
We were walking again, side by side, I still humming my little tune. "How jolly," I said brightly. "Moonlight picnics must be great fun. Did you ever go to them?"
"Once or twice," he said.
I pretended not to notice his manner, how quiet it had become, how reluctant to speak about these things. "Why is the boy there in the little harbour place?" I said.
"The boat used to be moored there," he said.
"What boat?" I asked.
"Her boat," he said.
A strange sort of excitement was upon me. I had to go on with my questions. He did not want to talk about it. I knew that. But although I was sorry for him and shocked at my own self, I had to continue. I could not be silent. "What happened to it?" I said. "Was that the boat she was sailing when she was drowned?"
"Yes," he said quietly. "It capsized and sank. She was washed overboard."
"What sort of size boat was it?" I asked.
"About 3 tons. It had a little cabin." "What made it capsize?" I said. "It can be very squally in the bay," he said. I thought of that green sea, foam-flecked, that ran down channel beyond the headland. Did the wind come suddenly, I wondered, in a funnel from the beacon on the hill? And did the little boat heel to it, shivering, the white sail flat against a breaking sea? "Could not someone have got out to her?" I said. "Nobody saw the accident. Nobody knew she had gone," he said. I was very careful not to look at him. He might have seen the surprise in my face. I had always thought it happened in a sailing race, that other boats were there, the boats from Kerith, and the people were watching from the cliffs. I did not know she had been alone, quite alone, out there in the bay. "They must have known up at the house," I said. "No," he said. "She often went out alone like that. She would come back any time of the night and sleep at the cottage on the beach."
"Wasn't she nervous?"
"Nervous," he said. "No, she was not nervous of anything."
Did Maxim mind her going off alone like that?
He waited a minute, and then, "I don't know," he said shortly. I had the impression he was being loyal to someone, either to Maxim or to Rebecca, or perhaps even to himself. He was odd. I did not know what to make of it. "She must have been drowned then, trying to swim to shore after the boat sank," I said.
"Yes," he said.
I knew how the little boat would quiver and plunge, the water gushing into the steering well, and how the sails would press her down, suddenly, horribly, in that gust of wind. It must have been very dark out there in the bay. The shore must have seemed very far away to anyone swimming there in the water. "How long afterwards was it that they found her?" I said.
"About 2 months," he said.
2 months. I thought drowned people were found after 2 days. I thought they would be washed up close to the shore when the tide came. "Where did they find her?" I asked.
"Near Edgecombe, about 40 miles up channel," he said.
I had spent a holiday at Edgecombe once, when I was 7. It was a big place with a pier and donkeys. I remembered riding a donkey along the sands. "How did they know it was her after 2 months? How could they tell?" I said. I wondered why he paused before each sentence, as though he weighed his words. Had he cared for her then? Had he minded so much?
"Maxim went up to Edgecombe to identify her," he said.
Suddenly I did not want to ask him any more. I felt sick at myself, sick and disgusted. I was like a curious sightseer standing on the fringe of a crowd after someone had been knocked down. I was like a poor person in a tenement building when someone had died, asking if I might see the body. I hated myself. My questions had been degrading, shameful. Frank Crawley must despise me. "It was a terrible time for all of you," I said rapidly. "I don't suppose you like being reminded about it. I just wondered if there was anything one could do to the cottage, that's all. It seemed such a pity, all the furniture being spoilt by the damp." He did not say anything. I felt hot and uncomfortable. He must have sensed that it was not concern for the empty cottage that had prompted me to all these questions, and now he was silent because he was shocked at me. Ours had been a comfortable, steady sort of friendship. I had felt him an ally. Perhaps I had destroyed all this, and he would never feel the same about me again. "What a long drive this is," I said. "It always reminds me of the path in the forest in a Grimm's fairy tale, where the prince gets lost, you know? It's always longer than one expects, and the trees are so dark and close." "Yes, it is rather exceptional," he said. I could tell by his manner he was still on his guard, as though waiting for a further question from me. There was an awkwardness between us that could not be ignored. Something had to be done about it, even if it covered me with shame. "Frank," I said desperately, "I know what you are thinking. You can't understand why I asked all those questions just now. You think I'm morbid and curious in a rather beastly way. It's not that, I promise you. It's only that sometimes I feel myself at such a disadvantage. It's all very strange to me, living here at Manderley, not the sort of life I've been brought up to. When I go returning these calls, as I did this afternoon, I know people are looking me up and down, wondering what sort of success I'm going to make of it. I can imagine them saying, "What on earth does Maxim see in her?" And then, Frank, I begin to wonder myself, and I begin to doubt, and I have a fearful, haunting feeling that I should never have married Maxim, that we are not going to be happy. You see, I know that all the time, whenever I meet anyone new, they are all thinking the same thing, how different she is to Rebecca. I stopped, breathless, already a little ashamed of my outburst, feeling that now, at any rate, I had burnt my boats for all time. He turned to me, looking very concerned and troubled. "Mrs. De Winter, please don't think that," he said. "For my part, I can't tell you how delighted I am that you have married Maxim. It will make all the difference to his life. I am positive that you will make a great success of it. From my point of view, it's very refreshing and charming to find someone like yourself who is not entirely, he blushed, searching for a word, "not entirely au fait, shall we say, with ways at Manderley. And if people around here give you the impression that they're criticizing you, it's most damnably offensive of them, that's all. I've never heard a word of criticism, and if I did, I should take great care that it was never uttered again."
"That's very sweet of you, Frank," I said, "and what you say helps enormously. I dare say I've been very stupid. I'm not good at meeting people. I've never had to do it, and all the time I keep remembering how it must have been at Manderley before, when there was someone there who was born and bred to it, did it all naturally and without effort, and I realize every day that things I lack, confidence, grace, beauty, intelligence, wit, oh, all the qualities that mean most in a woman, she possessed. It doesn't help, Frank. It doesn't help."
He said nothing. He went on looking anxious and distressed. He pulled out his handkerchief and blew his nose. "You must not say that," he said.
"Why not? It's true," I said.
"You have qualities that are just as important, far more so, in fact. It's perhaps cheek of me to say so. I don't know you very well. I'm a bachelor. I don't know very much about women. I lead a quiet sort of life down here at Manderley, as you know. But I should say that kindness and sincerity, and, if I may say so, modesty are worth far more to a man, to a husband, than all the wit and beauty in the world." He looked very agitated and blew his nose again. I saw that I had upset him far more than I had upset myself, and the realization of this calmed me and gave me a feeling of superiority. I wondered why he was making such a fuss. After all, I had not said very much. I had only confessed my sense of insecurity, following as I did upon Rebecca. And she must have had these qualities that he presented to me as mine. She must have been kind and sincere with all her friends, her boundless popularity. I was not sure what he meant by modesty. It was a word I had never understood. I always imagined it had something to do with minding meeting people in a passage on the way to the bathroom. Poor Frank. And Beatrice had called him a dull man with never a word to say for himself. "Well," I said, rather embarrassed, "well, I don't know about all that. I don't think I'm very kind or particularly sincere, and as for being modest, I don't think I've ever had much of a chance to be anything else. It was not very modest, of course, being married hurriedly like that down in Monte Carlo, and being alone there in that hotel beforehand, but perhaps you don't count that."
"My dear Mrs. De Winter, you don't think, I imagine, for one moment that your meeting down there was not entirely above board," he said in a low voice.
"No, of course not," I said gravely. Dear Frank, I think I had shocked him. What a Frankish expression, too. Above board. It made one think immediately of the sort of things that would happen below board. "I'm sure," he began, and hesitated, his expression still troubled, "I'm sure that Maxim would be very worried, very distressed, if he knew how you felt. I don't think he can have any idea of it."
"You won't tell him," I said hastily.
"No, naturally not. What do you take me for?"
"But you see, Mrs. De Winter, I know Maxim pretty well, and I've seen him through many moods. If he thought you were worrying about, well, about the past, it would distress him more than anything on earth.
I can promise you that. He's looking very well, very fit. But Mrs. Lacey was quite right the other day when she said he had been on the verge of a breakdown last year, though it was tactless of her to say so in front of him. That's why you were so good for him. You were fresh and young and sensible. You have nothing to do with all that time that has gone. Forget it, Mrs. De Winter. Forget it, as he has done, thank heaven, and the rest of us. We none of us want to bring back the past. Maxim, least of all, and it's up to you, you know, to lead us away from it, not to take us back there again. He was right. Of course he was right. Dear, good Frank, my friend, my ally, I had been selfish and hypersensitive, a martyr to my own inferiority complex. I ought to have told you all this before, I said. I wish you had, he said. I might have spared you some worry. I feel happier, I said, much happier. And I've got you for my friend, whatever happens, haven't I, Frank?
Yes, indeed, he said.
We were out of the dark wooded drive and into the light again. The rhododendrons were upon us. Their hour would soon be over. Already they looked a little overblown, a little faded. Next month the petals would fall one by one from the great faces, and the gardeners would come and sweep them away. Theirs was a brief beauty, not lasting very long. Frank, I said, before we put an end to this conversation forever, let's say, will you promise to answer me one thing, quite truthfully? He paused, looking at me a little suspiciously. That's not quite fair, he said. You might ask me something that I should not be able to answer, something quite impossible. No, I said, it's not that sort of question. It's not intimate or personal or anything like that.
Very well, I'll do my best, he said.
We came round the sweep of the drive, and Manderley was before us, serene and peaceful in the hollow of the lawns, surprising me, as it always did, with its perfect symmetry and grace, its great simplicity. The sunlight flickered on the mullioned windows, and there was a soft, rusted glow about the stone walls where the lichen clung. A thin column of smoke curled from the library chimney.
I bit my thumbnail, watching Frank out of the tail of my eye.
Tell me, I said, my voice casual, not caring a bit. Tell me, was Rebecca very beautiful? Frank waited a moment. I could not see his face. He was looking away from me towards the house.
Yes, he said slowly. Yes.
I suppose she was the most beautiful creature I ever saw in my life. We went up the steps then to the hall, and I rang the bell for tea. Chapter 12. I did not see much of Mrs. Danvers. She kept very much to herself. She still rang the house telephone to the morning room every day and submitted the menu to me as a matter of form, but that was the limit of our intercourse. She had engaged a maid for me, Clarice, the daughter of somebody on the estate, a nice, quiet, well-mannered girl who, thank heaven, had never been in service before and had no alarming standards. I think she was the only person in the house who stood in awe of me. To her, I was the mistress. I was Mrs. De Winter. The possible gossip of the others could not affect her. She had been away for some time, brought up by an aunt 15 miles away, and in a sense she was as new to Manderley as I was. I felt at ease with her. I did not mind saying, "Oh, Clarice, would you mend my stocking?" The housemaid, Alice, had been so superior. I used to sneak my chemise and nightgowns out of my drawer and mend them myself, rather than ask her to do them. I had seen her once, with one of my chemises over her arm, examining the plain material with its small edging of lace. I shall never forget her expression. She looked almost shocked, as though her own personal pride had received a blow. I had never thought about my underclothes before. As long as they were clean and neat, I had not thought the material or the existence of lace mattered. Brides, one read about, had trousseaus, dozens of sets at a time, and I had never bothered. Alice's face taught me a lesson. I wrote quickly to a shop in London and asked for a catalogue of underlinen. By the time I had made my choice, Alice was looking after me no longer, and Clarice was installed instead. It seemed such a waste buying new underclothes for Clarice that I put the catalogue away in a drawer and never wrote to the shop after all. I often wondered whether Alice told the others, and if my underclothes became a topic of conversation in the servants' hall, something rather dreadful to be discussed in low tones when the men were nowhere about. She was too superior for it to be made a joking question. Phrases like chemise to you would never be bandied between her and Frith, for instance. No, my underclothes were more serious than that, more like a divorce case heard in camera. At any rate, I was glad when Alice surrendered me to Clarice. Clarice would never know real lace from false. It was considerate of Mrs. Danvers to have engaged her. She must have thought we would be fit company, one for the other. Now that I knew the reason for Mrs. Danvers' dislike and resentment, it made things a little easier. I knew it was not just me personally she hated, but what I represented. She would have felt the same towards anyone who had taken Rebecca's place. At least, that was what I understood from Beatrice the day she came to lunch. "Did not you know?" she had said. "She simply adored Rebecca." The words had shocked me at the time. Somehow, I had not expected them. But when I thought it over, I began to lose my first fear of Mrs. Danvers. I began to be sorry for her. I could imagine what she must feel. It must hurt her every time she heard me called Mrs. De Winter. Every morning, when she took up the house telephone and spoke to me, and I answered, "Yes, Mrs. Danvers," she must be thinking of another voice. When she passed through the rooms and saw traces of me about the place, a berry on a window seat, a bag of knitting on a chair, she must think of another one who had done these things before, even as I did, I who had never known Rebecca. Mrs. Danvers knew how she walked and how she spoke. Mrs. Danvers knew the colour of her eyes, her smile, the texture of her hair. I knew none of these things. I had never asked about them. But sometimes I felt Rebecca was as real to me as she was to Mrs. Danvers. Frank had told me to forget the past, and I wanted to forget it. But Frank did not have to sit in the morning room as I did, every day, and touch the pen she had held between her fingers. He did not have to rest his hands on the blotter and stare in front of him at her writing on the pigeonholes. He did not have to look at the candlesticks on the mantelpiece, the clock, the vase in which the flowers stood, the pictures on the walls, and remember every day that they belonged to her. She had chosen them. They were not mine at all. Frank did not have to sit at her place in the dining room, hold the knife and fork that she had held, drink from her glass. He did not throw a coat over his shoulders which had been hers, nor find her handkerchief in the pocket. He did not notice every day, as I did, the blind gaze of the old dog in its basket in the library, who lifted its head when it heard my footstep, the footstep of a woman, and sniffing the air, drooped its head again, because I was not the one she sought. Little things, meaningless and stupid in themselves, but they were there for me to see, for me to hear, for me to feel. Dear God, I did not want to think about Rebecca. I wanted to be happy, to make Maxim happy, and I wanted us to be together. There was no other wish in my heart but that. I could not help it if she came to me in thoughts, in dreams. I could not help it if I felt like a guest in Manderley, my home, walking where she had trodden, resting where she had lain. I was like a guest, biding my time, waiting for the return of the hostess. Little sentences, little reproofs, reminding me every hour, every day. "Frith," I said, coming into the library on a summer morning, my arms full of lilac, "Frith, where can I find a tall vase for these? They're all too small in the flower room." "The white alabaster vase in the drawing room was always used for the lilac, madam." "Oh, wouldn't it be spoiled? It might get broken." "Mrs. De Winter always used the alabaster vase, madam." Oh, I see." Then the alabaster vase was brought for me, already filled with water, and as I put the sweet lilac in the vase and arranged the sprigs, one by one, the mauve warm scent filling the room, mingling with the smell of the new-mown lawn outside coming from the open window, I thought,
Rebecca did this. She took the lilac as I am doing, and put the sprigs one by one in the white vase. I'm not the first to do it. This is Rebecca's vase. This is Rebecca's lilac. She must have wandered out into the garden as I did in that floppy garden hat that I had seen once at the back of the cupboard in the flower room, hidden under some old cushions, and crossed the lawn to the lilac bushes, whistling perhaps, humming a tune, calling to the dogs to follow her, carrying in her hands the scissors that I carried now. Frith, could you move that bookstand from the table in the window, and I will put the lilac there? Mrs. De Winter always had the alabaster vase on the table behind the sofa, madam. Oh, well, I hesitated, the vase in my hands, Frith's face impassive. He would obey me, of course, if I said I preferred to put the vase on the smaller table by the window. He would move the bookstand at once. All right, I said. Perhaps it would look better on the larger table. And the alabaster vase stood, as it had always done, on the table behind the sofa. Beatrice remembered her promise of a wedding present. A large parcel arrived one morning, almost too large for Robert to carry. I was sitting in the morning room, having just read the menu for the day. I have always had a childish love of parcels. I snipped the string excitedly and tore off the dark brown paper. It looked like books. I was right. It was books. Four big volumes. A History of Painting. And a sheet of notepaper in the first volume saying, "I hope this is the sort of thing you like," and signed, "Love from Beatrice." I could see her going into the shop in Wigmore Street and buying them, looking about her in her abrupt, rather masculine way. "I want a set of books for someone who's keen on art," she would say, and the attendant would answer, "Yes, madam, will you come this way?" She would finger the volumes a little suspiciously. "Yes, that's about the price. It's for a wedding present. I want them to look good. Are these all about art?" "Yes, this is the standard work on the subject," the assistant would say. And then Beatrice must have written her note and paid her check and given the address. Mrs. De Winter, Manderley. It was nice of Beatrice. There was something rather sincere and pathetic about her going off to a shop in London and buying me these books because she knew I was fond of painting. She imagined me, I expect, sitting down on a wet day and looking solemnly at the illustrations, and perhaps getting a sheet of drawing paper and a paint box and copying one of the pictures. Dear Beatrice, I had a sudden, stupid desire to cry. I gathered up the heavy volumes and looked round the morning room for somewhere to put them. They were out of place in that fragile, delicate room. Never mind, it was my room now, after all. I arranged them in a row on the top of the desk. They swayed dangerously, leaning one against the other. I stood back a bit to watch the effect. Perhaps I moved too quickly, and it disturbed them. At any rate, the foremost one fell, and the others slid after him. They upset a little china Cupid, who had hitherto stood alone on the desk, except for the candlesticks. He fell to the ground, hitting the waste paper basket as he did so, and broke into fragments. I glanced hurriedly at the door like a guilty child. I knelt on the floor and swept up the pieces into my hand. I found an envelope to put them in. I hid the envelope at the back of one of the drawers in the desk. Then I took the books off to the library and found room for them on the shelves. Maxim laughed when I showed them to him with pride. "Dear old Bee," he said. "You must have had a success with her. She never opens a book if she can help it."
"Did she say anything about, well, what she thought of me?" I asked.
"The day she came to lunch?" "No, I don't think so."
"I thought she might have written or something."
"Beatrice and I don't correspond unless there's a major event in the family. Writing letters is a waste of time," said Maxim.
I supposed I was not a major event. Yet if I had been Beatrice, and had a brother, and the brother married, surely one would have said something, expressed an opinion, written two words. Unless, of course, one had taken a dislike to the wife, or thought her unsuitable, then, of course, it would be different. Still, Beatrice had taken the trouble to go up to London and to buy the books for me. She would not have done that if she disliked me. It was the following day, I remember, when Frith, who had brought in the coffee after lunch to the library, waited a moment
hovering behind Maxim, and said, "Could I speak to you, sir?" Maxim glanced up from his paper.
"Yes, Frith, what is it?" he said, rather surprised.
Frith wore a stiff, solemn expression, his lips pursed. I thought at once his wife had died.
"It's about Robert, sir. There's been a slight unpleasantness between him and Mrs. Danvers. Robert is very upset."
"Oh, Lord," said Maxim, making a face at me. I bent down to fondle Jasper, my unfailing habit in moments of embarrassment.
"Yes, sir, it appears Mrs. Danvers has accused Robert of secreting a valuable ornament from the morning-room. It's Robert's business to bring in the fresh flowers to the morning-room and place the vases. Mrs. Danvers went in this morning after the flowers had been done and noticed one of the ornaments was missing. It was there yesterday, she said. She accused Robert of either taking the ornament or breaking it and concealing the breakage. Robert denied both accusations most emphatically and came to me nearly in tears, sir. You may have noticed he was not himself at lunch."
"I wondered why he handed me the cutlets without giving me a plate," murmured Maxim. "I did not know Robert was so sensitive. Well, I suppose someone else did it. One of the maids."
"No, sir. Mrs. Danvers went into the room before the girl had done the room. Nobody had been there since Madam yesterday, and Robert first thing with the flowers. It makes it very unpleasant for Robert and myself, sir."
"Yes, of course it does. Well, you would better ask Mrs. Danvers to come here, and we'll get to the bottom of it. What ornament was it, anyway?"
"The china cupid, sir, that stands on the writing-table."
Oh, Lord, that's one of our treasures, isn't it? It will have to be found. Get hold of Mrs. Danvers at once."
"Very good, sir." Frith left the room, and we were alone again.
"What a confounded nuisance," said Maxim. "That cupid is worth a hell of a lot. How I loathe servants' rows, too. I wonder why they come to me about it. That's your job, sweetheart."
I looked up from Jasper, my face red as fire. "Darling," I said, "I meant to tell you before, but I forgot. The fact is, I broke that cupid when I was in the morning room yesterday."
"You broke it? Well, why the devil didn't you say so when Frith was here?"
"I don't know. I didn't like to. I was afraid he would think me a fool."
"He'll think you much more of a fool now. You'll have to explain to him and Mrs. Danvers."
"Oh, no, please, Maxim, you tell them. Let me go upstairs."
"Don't be a little idiot. Anyone would think you were afraid of them."
"I am afraid of them. At least, not afraid, but..." The door opened, and Frith ushered Mrs. Danvers into the room. I looked nervously at Maxim. He shrugged his shoulders, half amused, half angry.
"It's all a mistake, Mrs. Danvers. Apparently Mrs. de Winter broke the cupid herself and forgot to say anything," said Maxim.
They all looked at me. It was like being a child again. I was still aware of my guilty flush. "I'm so sorry," I said, watching Mrs. Danvers. "I never thought Robert would get into trouble." "Is it possible to repair the ornament, madam?" said Mrs. Danvers. She did not seem to be surprised that I was the culprit. She looked at me with her white skull's face and her dark eyes. I felt she had known it was me all along, and had accused Robert to see if I would have the courage to confess. "I'm afraid not," I said. "It smashed in little pieces."
"What did you do with the pieces?" said Maxim.
It was like being a prisoner, giving evidence. How paltry and mean my action sounded, even to myself. "I put them all into an envelope," I said.
"Well, what did you do with the envelope?" said Maxim, lighting a cigarette, his tone a mixture of amusement and exasperation.
"I put it at the back of one of the drawers in the writing-desk," I said.
"It looks as though Mrs. de Winter thought you would put her in prison, doesn't it, Mrs. Danvers?" said Maxim. "Perhaps you would find the envelope and send the pieces up to London. If they're too far gone to mend it, it can't be helped. All right, Frith, tell Robert to dry his tears."
Mrs. Danvers lingered when Frith had gone. "I will apologize to Robert, of course," she said, "but the evidence pointed so strongly to him, it did not occur to me that Mrs. de Winter had broken the ornament herself. Perhaps if such a thing should happen again, Mrs. de Winter will tell me personally, and I will have the matter attended to. It would save everybody a lot of unpleasantness."
"Naturally," said Maxim impatiently. "I can't think why she didn't do so yesterday. I was just going to tell her when you came into the room."
"'Perhaps Mrs. de Winter was not aware of the value of the ornament,' said Mrs. Danvers, turning her eyes upon me. "'Yes,' I said wretchedly. "'Yes, I was afraid it was valuable. "'That's why I swept the pieces up so carefully.'
"'And hid them at the back of a drawer where no one would find them, eh?' said Maxim, with a laugh and a shrug of the shoulders. "'Is not that the sort of thing the between-maid is supposed to do, Mrs. Danvers?'
"'The between-maid at Manderley would never be allowed to touch the valuable things in the morning-room, sir,' said Mrs. Danvers.
"'No, I can't see you letting her,' said Maxim.
"'It's very unfortunate,' said Mrs. Danvers. "'I don't think we've ever had any breakages in the morning-room before.' We were always so particular. I've done the dusting in there myself since... Last year, there was no one I could trust. When Mrs. de Winter was alive, we used to do the valuables together.
Yes, well, it can't be helped, said Maxim. All right, Mrs. Danvers.
She went out of the room, and I sat on the window seat, looking out of the window. Maxim picked up his paper again. Neither of us spoke. "'I'm awfully sorry, darling,' I said after a moment. "'It was very careless of me. "'I can't think how it happened. "'I was just arranging those books on the desk "'to see if they would stand, and the cupid slipped.'
"'My sweet child, forget it. "'What does it matter?'
"'It does matter. "'I ought to have been more careful. "'Mrs. Danvers must be furious with me.'
"'What the devil has she got to be furious about? "'It's not her bit of china.'
"'No, but she takes such a pride in it all. "'It's so awful to think nothing in there has ever been broken before. "'It had to be me.'
"'Better you than the luckless Robert.'
"'I wish it had been Robert. "'Mrs. Danvers will never forgive me.'
"'Damn Mrs. Danvers,' said Maxim. "'She's not God Almighty, is she? "'I can't understand you. "'What do you mean by saying you're afraid of her?'
"'I did not mean afraid, exactly. "'I don't see much of her. "'It's not that. I can't really explain.'
"'You do such extraordinary things,' said Maxim.' "'Fancy not getting hold of her when you broke the thing "'and saying, "'Here, Mrs. Danvers, get this mended. "'She'd understand that. "'Instead of which, you scrape up the remains in an envelope "'and hide them at the back of a drawer, "'just like a between-maid, as I said, "'and not the mistress of a house.'
"'I am like a between-maid,' I said slowly. "'I know I am, in lots of ways. "'That's why I have so much in common with Clarice. "'We're on the same sort of footing, "'and that's why she likes me.' "'I went and saw her mother the other day. "'And do you know what she said? "'I asked her if she thought Clarice was happy with us, "'and she said, "'Oh, yes, Mrs. de Winter, Clarice seems quite happy. "'She says it's not like being with the lady, mum. "'It's like being with one of ourselves.' "'Do you suppose she meant it as a compliment or not?'
"'God, no,' said Maxim. "'Remembering Clarice's mother, I should take it as a direct insult. "'Her cottage is generally a shambles and smells of boiled cabbage.' At one time she had 9 children under 11, and she herself used to patter about in that patch of garden with no shoes and a stocking round her head. We nearly gave her notice to quit. Why Clarice looks as neat and clean as she does, I can't imagine.
She's been living with an aunt, I said, feeling rather subdued. I know my flannel skirt has a dirty mark down the front, but I've never walked barefoot with a stocking round my head. I knew now why Clarice did not disdain my underclothes as Alice had done. "'Perhaps that's why I prefer calling on Clarice's mother to calling on people like the bishop's wife,' I went on. "'The bishop's wife never said I was like one of themselves.
"'If you wear that grubby skirt when you call on her, I don't suppose she does,' said Maxim.
"'Of course I didn't call on her in my old skirt. "'I wore a frock,' I said. "'And anyway, I don't think much of people who just judge one by one's clothes.'
"'I hardly think the bishop's wife cares tuppence about clothes,' said Maxim. "'But she may have been rather surprised if you sat on the extreme edge of the chair "'and answered yes and no, like someone after a new job, "'which you did the only time we returned a call together.
"'I can't help being shy.
"'I know you can't, sweetheart, but you don't make an effort to conquer it.'
"'I think that's very unfair,' I said. "'I try every day, every time I go out or meet anyone new. "'I'm always making efforts.' You don't understand. It's all very well for you. You're used to that sort of thing. I've not been brought up to it.
Rot, said Maxim. It's not a question of bringing up, as you put it. It's a matter of application. You don't think I like calling on people, do you? It bores me stiff, but it has to be done in this part of the world.
We're not talking about boredom, I said. There's nothing to be afraid of in being bored. If I was just bored, it would be different. I hate people looking me up and down as though I were a prize cow.
Who looks you up and down?
All the people down here. Everybody.
What does it matter if they do?
It gives them some interest in life.
Why must I be the one to supply the interest and have all the criticism?
Because life at Manderley is the only thing that ever interests anybody down here.
What a slap in the eye I must be to them, then.
Maxim did not answer. He went on looking at his paper.
What a slap in the eye I must be to them, then, I repeated.
And then, I suppose that's why you married me, I said. You knew I was dull and quiet and inexperienced, so that there would never be any gossip about me.
Maxim threw his paper on the ground and got up from his chair.
What do you mean? He said.
His face was dark and queer, and his voice was rough. Not his voice at all.
I don't know, I said, leaning back against the window. I don't mean anything. Why do you look like that?
What do you know about any gossip down here? He said.
I don't, I said, scared by the way he looked at me. I only said it because of something to say. Don't look at me like that. Maxim, what have I said? What's the matter?
Who's been talking to you? He said slowly.
No one. No one at all.
Why did you say what you did?
I tell you, I don't know. It just came to my head. I was angry, cross. I do hate calling on these people. I can't help it. And you criticized me for being shy. I didn't mean it. Really, Maxim, I didn't. Please believe me.
It was not a particularly attractive thing to say, was it? He said.
No, I said. No, it was rude. Hateful.
He stared at me moodily, his hands in his pockets, rocking backwards and forwards on his heels.
I wonder if I did a very selfish thing in marrying you, he said.
He spoke slowly, thoughtfully. I felt very cold, rather sick. How do you mean? I said.
I'm not much of a companion to you, am I? He said. There are too many years between us. You ought to have waited and then married a boy of your own age, not someone like myself, with half his life behind him.
Well, that's ridiculous, I said hurriedly. You know age doesn't mean anything in marriage. Of course we are companions.
Are we? I don't know, he said.
I knelt up on the window seat and put my arms round his shoulders.
Why do you say these things to me, I said. You know I love you more than anything in the world. There has never been anyone but you. You are my father and my brother and my son, all those things.
It was my fault, he said, not listening. I rushed you into it. I never gave you a chance to think it over.
I did not want to think it over, I said. There was no other choice. You don't understand, Maxim. When one loves a person...
Are you happy here? He said,
looking away from me, out of the window.
I wonder sometimes. You've got thinner. Lost your colour.
Of course I'm happy, I said. I love Manderley. I love the garden. I love everything. I don't mind calling on people. I just said that to be tiresome. I'll call on people every day if you want me to. I don't mind what I do. I've never for one moment regretted marrying you. Surely you must know that.
He patted my cheek in his terrible absent way and bent down and kissed the top of my head.
Poor lamb. You don't have much fun, do you? I'm afraid I'm very difficult to live with.
You're not difficult, I said eagerly. You're easy, very easy, much easier than I thought you would be. I used to think it would be dreadful to be married, that one's husband would drink or use awful language or grumble if the toast was soft at breakfast and be rather unattractive altogether, smell possibly. You don't do any of those things.
Good God, I hope not, said Maxim.
And he smiled. I seized advantage of his smile. I smiled too, and took his hands and kissed them.
How absurd to say we are not companions, I said. Why, look how we sit here every evening, you with a book or a paper, and me with my knitting. Just like cups of tea. Just like old people, married for years and years. Of course we are companions, of course we are happy. You talk as though you thought we had made a mistake. You don't mean it like that, do you, Maxim? You know our marriage is a success, a wonderful success.
If you say so, then it's all right, he said.
No, but you think it too, don't you, darling? It's not just me. We are happy, aren't we? Terribly happy.
He did not answer. He went on, staring out of the window, while I held his hands. My throat felt dry,
and tight, and my eyes were burning. Oh, God, I thought, this is like two people in a play. In a moment, the curtain will come down. We shall bow to the audience and go off to our dressing rooms. This can't be a real moment in the lives of Maxim and myself. I sat down on the window seat and let go of his hands. I heard myself speaking in a hard, cool voice. If you don't think we are happy, it would be much better if you would admit it. I don't want you to pretend anything. I'd much rather go away, not live with you any more. It was not really happening, of course. It was the girl in the play talking, not me to Maxim. I pictured the type of girl who would play the part. Tall and slim, rather nervy. Well, why don't you answer me? He took my face in his hands and looked at me, just as he had before, when Frith had come into the room with tea, the day we went to the beach.
How can I answer you, he said. I don't know the answer myself. If you say we are happy, let's leave it at that. It's something I know nothing about. I take your word for it. We are happy. All right, then. That's agreed.
He kissed me again, and then walked away across the room. I went on sitting by the window, stiff and straight, my hands in my lap. You say all this because you are disappointed in me, I said. I'm gauche and awkward. I dress badly. I'm shy with people. I warned you in Monte Carlo how it would be. You think I'm not right for Manderley.
Don't talk nonsense, he said. I've never said you dressed badly or were gauche. It's your imagination. As for being shy, you'll get over that. I've told you so before.
We've argued in a circle, I said. We've come right back to where we started. This all began because I broke the Cupid in the morning room. If I hadn't broken the Cupid, none of this would have happened. We'd have drunk our coffee and gone out into the garden.
Oh, damn that infernal Cupid, said Maxim wearily. Do you really think I care whether it's in 10,000 pieces or not?
Was it very valuable?
Heaven knows, I suppose so. I've really forgotten.
Are all those things in the morning room valuable?
Yes, I believe so.
Why were all the most valuable things put in the morning room?
I don't know. I suppose because they look well there.
Were they always there, when your mother was alive?
No. No, I don't think they were. They were scattered about the house. The chairs were in a lumber room, I believe.
When was the morning room furnished, as it is now?
When I was married.
I suppose the Cupid was put there then.
Well, I suppose so.
Was that found in a lumber room?
No. No, I don't think it was. As a matter of fact, I believe it was a wedding present. Rebecca knew a lot about china.
I did not look at him. I began to polish my nails. He had said the word quite naturally, quite calmly. It had been no effort to him. After a minute, I glanced at him swiftly. He was standing by the mantelpiece, his hands in his pockets. He was staring straight in front of him. He is thinking about Rebecca, I said to myself. He is thinking how strange it was that a wedding present to me should have been the cause of destroying a wedding present to Rebecca. He is thinking about the Cupid. He is remembering who gave it to Rebecca. He is going over in his mind how the parcel came and how pleased she was. Rebecca knew a lot about china. Perhaps he came into the room and she was kneeling on the floor, wrenching open the little crate in which the Cupid was packed. She must have glanced up at him and smiled. Look, Max, she would have said. Look what we've been sent. And she then would have plunged her hand down into the shavings and brought out the Cupid, who stood on one foot, his bow in his hand. We'll have it in the morning room, she must have said, and he must have knelt down beside her, and they must have looked at the Cupid together. I went on polishing my nails. They were scrubby, like a schoolboy's nails. The cuticles grew up over the half-moons. The thumb was bitten nearly to the quick. I looked at Maxim again. He was still standing in front of the fireplace. What are you thinking about? I said. My voice was steady and cool, not like my heart thumping inside me, not like my mind bitter and resentful. He lit a cigarette, surely the 25th that day, and we had only just finished lunch. He threw the match into the empty grate. He picked up the paper.
Nothing very much.
Why? He said. "Oh, I don't know," I said. "You looked so serious, so far away."
He whistled a tune absently, a cigarette twisting in his fingers. "As a matter of fact, I was wondering if they had chosen the Surrey side to play Middlesex at the Oval," he said.
He sat down in the chair again and folded the paper. I looked out of the window. Presently, Jasper came to me and climbed on my lap.
Chapter 13. Maxim had to go up to London at the end of June to some public dinner, a man's dinner, something to do with the county. He was away for 2 days, and I was left alone. I dreaded his going. When I saw the car disappear round the sweep in the drive, I felt exactly as though it were to be a final parting, and I should never see him again. There would be an accident, of course, and later on in the afternoon, when I came back from my walk, I should find Frith, white and frightened, waiting for me with a message. The doctor would have rung up from some cottage hospital. "You must be very brave," he would say. "I'm afraid you must be prepared for a great shock." And Frank would come, and we would go to the hospital together. Maxim would not recognize me. I went through the whole thing as I was sitting at lunch. I could see the crowd of local people clustering round the churchyard at the funeral, and myself leaning on Frank's arm. It was so real to me that I could scarcely eat any lunch, and I kept straining my ears to hear the telephone should it ring. I sat out in the garden under the chestnut tree in the afternoon with a book on my lap, but I scarcely read at all. When I saw Robert come across the lawn, I knew it was the telephone, and I felt physically sick. "A message from the club, madam, to say Mr. De Winter arrived 10 minutes ago." I shut up my book. "Thank you, Robert. How quickly he got up." "Yes, madam, a very good run." "Did he ask to speak to me or leave any special message?" "No, madam, just that he had arrived safely. It was the porter speaking." "All right, Robert. Thanks very much." The relief was tremendous. I did not feel sick any more. The pain had gone. It was like coming ashore after a channel crossing. I began to feel rather hungry, and when Robert had gone back into the house, I crept into the dining room through the long window and stole some biscuits from the sideboard. I had 6 of them, Bath Olivers, and then an apple as well. I had no idea I was so empty. I went and ate them in the woods in case one of the servants should see me on the lawn from the windows, and then go and tell the cook that they did not think Mrs. De Winter cared for the food prepared in the kitchen, as they had just seen her filling herself with fruit and biscuits. The cook would be offended, and perhaps go to Mrs. Danvers. Now that Maxim was safe in London, and I had eaten my biscuits, I felt very well and curiously happy. I was aware of a sense of freedom, as though I had no responsibilities at all. It was rather like a Saturday when one was a child. No lessons and no prep. One could do as one liked. One put on an old skirt and a pair of sand shoes and played hares and hounds on the common with the children who lived next door. I had just the same feeling. I had not felt like this all the time I had been at Manderley. It must be because Maxim had gone to London. I was rather shocked at myself. I could not understand it at all. I had not wanted him to go. And now this lightness of heart, this spring in my step, this childish feeling that I wanted to run across the lawn and roll down the bank. I wiped the biscuit crumbs from my mouth and called to Jasper. Perhaps I was just feeling like this because it was a lovely day. We went through the Happy Valley to the little cove. The azaleas were finished now. The petals lay brown and crinkled on the moss. The bluebells had not faded yet. They made a solid carpet in the woods above the valley, and the young bracken was shooting up, curling and green. The moss smelt rich and deep, and the bluebells were earthy, bitter. I lay down in the long grass beside the bluebells with my hands behind my head and Jasper at my side. He looked down at me, panting, his face foolish, saliva dripping from his tongue and his heavy jowl. There were pigeons somewhere in the trees above. It was very peaceful and quiet. I wondered why it was that places are so much lovelier when one is alone. How commonplace and stupid it would be if I had a friend now sitting beside me, someone I had known at school, who would say, "By the way, I saw old Hilda the other day. You remember her? The one who was so good at tennis. She's married with 2 children."
and the bluebells beside us unnoticed, and the pigeons overhead unheard. I did not want anyone with me, not even Maxim. If Maxim had been there,